Thanks, Alex, and thanks UBCBCCLA, which is a mouthful, but thanks very much for hosting me today. This talk, I subtitled it A Quick Overview of Legal Issues, because that's what it'll be. I'm going to talk for maybe about 45 minutes, and that's not even close to long enough to address all the legal issues. How many people here are law students, just so I get a sense of, okay, it's a largely legal audience, and then certainly people are familiar with legal issues. I recognize a couple faces. So this will be at more of a sort of legal perspective. I'm going to be doing a talk in early November at Green College, which will be more of a sort of popular perspective as far as the legal issues are concerned. I'm going to address three main legal issues here with you folks today. The first is the free speech bylaws that were introduced by the City of Vancouver, and then the provincial legislation that was introduced last week in first reading called Bill 13. Agents provocateurs and the law surrounding what police and police agents are and aren't allowed to do when they're undercover, because that is and has become an important issue around this particular event. And finally, the legal structure of VANOC and constitutional accountability, whether or not VANOC is a government actor for the purposes of the charter, whether or not you can use the charter to enforce constitutional norms on that organization. And the answer so far is, well, we'll see. Free speech. Our organization is about 50 years old, or 45 years old. We were formed in the 60s. And one of the continuing and most important mandates of the organization is the free speech issue. The organization is founded on the largely small liberal philosophies of John Stuart Mill, with some modifications to bring in substantive equality issues of various forms. But at its heart, the organization believes that the only way that we can address the issues that are facing us is to have full and frank discussion about issues, and not to try to restrict speech around issues, because by restricting speech, what you do is you effectively give those ideas more currency than they necessarily deserve. And not only that, you cause people to, instead of talking about issues, resort to activities like terrorism to get their ideas across, because they don't have a space to express those ideas. So at its core, free speech and protecting free speech in our minds and our organization's philosophy is actually a security-enhancing idea. By promoting free speech and protecting free speech, you're actually protecting everyone's security and discouraging terrorist activity, discouraging activity that would otherwise affect people's safety. Free speech has sort of an interesting history with the Olympics. There are a number of high-profile events related to free speech. Most recently in Beijing, discussions around the protest pens in Beijing and how people had to register to protest, and how the protest pens ended up sitting empty when no one got approved to protest and those who applied were arrested. But if you go further back, athletes, for example, giving the Black Power sign, the upraised fist when receiving medals were subject to censure. And there was a discussion about how do we, within the Olympic movement, about how do we keep the Olympic movement separate from political propaganda, how do we keep it separate from commercial influence, and they came up with something called the Olympic Charter. Now, the Olympic Charter is a document that they have adopted for themselves, but one of the provisions says that all the venues, the Olympics themselves, should be free from commercial propaganda, religious propaganda, and any indicators that that the Olympics is somehow politically in favor or opposed to one particular political system or another. Just the broad philosophy of the Olympic movement compared to the broad philosophy of the Civil Liberties Association and generally the Civil Liberties philosophy. So you can see that we might not agree on everything. Back in 2003, when Vancouver was awarded the Olympic Games, the city was required to sign a contract with the International Olympic Committee. Now, the Olympics are awarded specifically to cities. They're not given to private actors, they're given to government actors, and this will be important later on in our discussion about whether or not the charter applies. But when the Olympic Games were awarded to Vancouver, there was a host city agreement, and in that agreement was clause number 47 that gives effect to section 51 of the Olympic Charter, which is the city, the NOC is the National Olympic Committee. So there's a National Olympic Committee that fields an Olympic team of athletes every year for Canada, that's the NOC. And the OCOG, which is the Olympic Organizing Committee, initially the bid committee, and then later on VANOC, the organizing committee. All of those three signed this contract and made this promise to the International Olympic Committee. The International Olympic Committee is a separate organization located in Geneva, Switzerland, that owns all the copyright and trademarks over the Olympic marks, the Olympic Games, and they are a private corporation there. So you see in this clause, the city promises that the Olympic Charter provisions relating to propaganda and advertising will be strictly observed. And most importantly, this clause right here, the city, the NOC, and the OCOG shall ensure that no propaganda or advertising is placed within the Olympic venues or outside the Olympic venues in such a manner so as to be within the view of the television cameras covering the sports of the games or of the spectators watching the sports of the games. The question, there are a couple questions, and you probably all are at various stages of having done contract law or you're in contract law. There are a couple questions about the enforceability of this contract. First is the jurisdiction of the city to be able to enter a contract that essentially guarantees that in public space outside Olympic venues that there will be no religious or political propaganda. Is the city actually able to enter into a contract like that? Now, the city certainly purported to. This contract was signed by the mayor of the city of Vancouver at the time, Larry Campbell. And it is this contract that the city has both formally and informally pointed to as the reason for passing the bylaws that I'm going to talk about shortly. But the first question is, does the city have the jurisdiction to sign? And the second is, would the courts actually give effect to this contract? Or would they, for public policy reasons, like when you're looking at contracts that essentially that have racist provisions, for example, for public policy reasons that the court would not give effect to those contracts? Here, a contract that ostensibly restricts public free expression outside of Olympic venues. Would a court look at this if the city failed to prevent people from picketing outside the venues? Would a court hold the city liable for signing the contract and failing, breaching the contract for any damages that would flow to Van Ock as a result of the breach? And the answer, I think, in both cases is likely no. But the city decided that they would give effect to this contract that was signed actually not by the previous administration, but the administration before that, feeling that it bound the city to prevent Olympic propaganda or prevent religious and political propaganda from being inside and outside of Olympic venues. And to give effect to that contract in July of this year, July 23rd, I remember because it was 2 days after my birthday and I was out of town for the introduction of this particular piece of exciting legislation. This is the 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Winter Games bylaw, and in their public communications, the city called this the Olympic Relaxation Bylaw. This is going to relax the rules around the city, the very strict rules of no fun Vancouver, let the bars stay open later, let garbage delivery be picked up later, that we were actually going to be relaxing the rules around the Olympics related to pretty much all of the city's operations. Now, the truth of the matter was actually quite the opposite, that there was a restriction on how citizens could express themselves in a number of very important areas within the city. These are the most troubling provisions, in my opinion, in the Games bylaw. And they focus on how you may express yourself in an area that I counted to be about 40 square city blocks downtown. And we'll look at a couple of the perimeters so you get a sense of what's involved. But the bylaw starts out by defining what a celebratory sign is. And this is my favorite because everyone gets a kick out of this. A celebratory sign is a sign that celebrates the 2010 Winter Games and creates or enhances a festive environment and atmosphere for the 2010 Winter Games. So that's a celebratory sign. And it's celebratory signs that are expressly permitted within the bylaws. Now, I don't know if I reproduce the particular section on the 8 sub C here. The bylaw expressly restricts all signs except for signs that are pre-existing and any sign on a street that is a celebratory sign, so if you've got a celebratory sign, you're all right, or a wayfaring sign that's authorized by Van Ock or the city. Now, there's a sort of statutory interpretation issue of whether it's celebratory signs authorized by Van Ock or the city, or it's celebratory signs simpliciter, that is, if you don't have an authorization from the city, you can just hold up your celebratory sign. But either way, it's unconstitutional because it purports to limit the ability of the city to authorize signs that are not celebratory in the best case scenario. In the worst case scenario, it says that you can hold celebratory signs with or without authorization of the city, but you're not allowed to hold any other signs in these areas that are set out by the bylaw. In addition to that provision, there is also a prohibition on, if you look at 4B sub B, a prohibition on causing any disturbance that could interfere with the enjoyment of entertainment on city land by other persons. Now, if you've done criminal law, you know about breach of the peace. That already exists on lawful assemblies. There are criminal provisions against causing or participating in a riot. So it's not clear about what this provision of causing a disturbance or nuisance adds to the existing breach of the peace provisions, but one would assume that there was some kind of a gap that breach of the peace didn't address that the city's trying to address through this provision. So if you put these two together, that you're not allowed anything except for a sign that's celebratory, and you're also not allowed to create a disturbance that interferes with other people's enjoyment of Olympic activity, you've prohibited all of the activities associated with traditional protests. So if you picture someone picketing, they've got a sign, they're chanting, they're singing songs. You know, it's sort of the stereotypical protest. If you picture a protest in your mind, those are the activities associated with protests. And here the bylaws themselves restrict the ability of people to do that. Not only that, in the bottom, sub 7 here, you're not allowed to hand out any leaflets or distribute any advertising material during the games, unless you're an official Olympic sponsor and it's sanctioned by the IOC and by the city. So all of the independent businesses that are on Robson Street, on Granville Street, Hastings, and we'll go through the list of the streets, but it's significant, will not be able to say, hey, we've got a pizza special on today, Olympic tourists, come on in. Because independent businesses do not count. The only businesses that count are the Olympic sponsors and the wishes of the IOC to protect those Olympic sponsors. So we'll have a look at the perimeters where the bylaw purports to extend its authority. And you need to understand that there's a provision in the bylaw that says that these perimeters can be expanded without notice by the city engineer, and that the rules within the perimeters can be changed without notice by the city manager. It doesn't have to go to council. The only notice that's required is a posting at the outside of the perimeter that sets out the new rule. So I'm not sure quite where they put the postings over this huge area, but presumably on the telephone poles, I don't know. But it's somewhere around here, there would be postings that say there's a new rule, here's what the new rule is, and the perimeters could be expanded at any time. This is David Land Park. For those of you from Vancouver, you might be familiar with it. It's in Yale Town. So there's, I think I've got the right area here. There's sort of an Urban Fair grocery store here, I think. And then we've got up here on the corner is the Roundhouse Community Center. And if that orients a couple people. But if you picture it in your mind, this block, this block, this block, and this block are all solid condominiums. So they're quite tall condominium projects in this block as well that overlook David Land Park within the perimeter that's set out by the bylaw. Within view of an Olympic venue, this is going to be a city live site. So if you apply the principles of the bylaw, if you put up a non-celebratory sign in your window overlooking the Olympic venue, you're violating the terms of the bylaw, and also the city of Vancouver, if you believe that contract would be enforceable, would be liable to VanOck for failing to act to have the sign removed. This is the second perimeter, for illustration purposes. This is GM Place, BC Place, and the Athletes Village Project. This is False Creek here, that's Science World. This is a one-block area around the Athletes Village. And over here, a number of condominium projects that are in these blocks, the Georgia Street Viaduct, and all of the associated streets surrounding this. And it kind of jumps out a little bit here to include the Vancouver Public Library as well. So you've got sites traditionally associated and very closely associated with free expression, the library within the perimeter. You also have a significant number of residential areas that overlook Olympic venues. And in addition, the whole of the seawall and all of the sort of broad assembly areas where you could theoretically assemble to protest. There are a number of vacant lots through here and areas where people could theoretically protest. So these perimeters where these new rules apply are very broad, and the rules themselves are completely alterable by the city manager without notice. So that was pretty bad. We saw the bylaw, we saw the perimeters, it was pretty heavy-handed stuff. And then it got worse. Last week, The Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act was introduced at the provincial legislature. And this is a very interesting piece of provincial legislation in that it responds to a request from the city of Vancouver for further powers. The city asked for powers to increase the fines related to illegal signs from $2,000 a day to $10,000 a day, and to shorten the notice periods. Traditionally, if you have an illegal sign in Vancouver, the city needs 2 weeks' notice to come into your place and remove it. So they post the notice, remove your illegal sign. 2 weeks later, a city worker can show up at your house, go on to your property, remove the sign. They wanted to shorten that notice period. They also wanted to shorten the notice period for removing graffiti from your house from 2 weeks to zero. They want to be able to go onto your property and remove graffiti without any notice period to you saying, hi, we're coming onto your property and we're going to remove that graffiti. The specific wording of it says that within the time period of the Olympic Games, so there's not even an idea that more broadly this power is needed, that it's addressing a gap in existing city powers. This change is only in place for the Olympic period, with the exception of the increase in the fines. The shortening of the notice periods is going to be in place from January until March 2010. So subject to this section, a person authorized by council of a specified municipality, there are three specified municipalities, Vancouver, Richmond, and Whistler. The unifying theme between those three is, of course, they're all Olympic cities. Has the authority to enter on property and to enter into property without the consent of the owner or occupier for the purpose of enforcing the specified municipality's bylaws in relation to signs. But don't worry, they're not allowed to just barge onto your property. They may only exercise the authority at reasonable times and in a reasonable manner. And they also must take reasonable steps to advise the owner or occupier before entering your property. They need to give you 24 hours written notice of the entry into your property and the reasons for it. And once they're on your property, they can remove, cover, or alter a sign that's in contravention of the municipality's bylaws. When you put this together with the bylaws that are already put in place by the City of Vancouver, you have a situation where, even if it's only theoretical, a system of powers has been created within municipal workers to enter into private property within perimeters that are defined in the bylaws that we've looked at that include hundreds, if not thousands, of condominium units to remove signs from the windows of the interiors of the houses of people that live there. Also to remove signs from the private property of businesses or any other land that people have that overlooks or is within these perimeters that overlooks venues. In addition, graffiti, if there's graffiti on the side of your house, the city worker can enter without notice and remove it at cost to you. So what does that mean legally? I mean, do these bylaws have a chance? Is there for those of you who have done constitutional law and you've looked at the free expression issue, is it possible that for the Olympic period, government might be allowed time, place, and manner restrictions over free expression? There was a case involving an airport when government used to have the authority over airports, when the court looked at the issue of leafletting within the airport property, and they said, well, does it interfere with the use of the airport as an airport, as a government property? And they said, you know, we'll let the leafletting go ahead at the airport, but we wouldn't let it go ahead in a government office because the time, place, and manner would not be appropriate or consistent with free expression. Because it's a government office, people need to get their work done. So there's theoretically an argument that could be made that the Olympics, because they're funded more than half by private sponsorship dollars, to protect those sponsors and the public investment in the games, it's necessary to have some restrictions on free expression. And the limits themselves are subject to the discretion of the enforcing officers, and they've already made public statements that they're not going to enforce against political signs, just commercial signs. So what's the big deal? The big deal is this case. This is a case called Greater Vancouver Transportation Authority and BC Transit. It's called the TransLink decision, more colloquially. This is the Canadian Federation of Students took TransLink to court and said that TransLink's policy of refusing to sell advertising to CFS, because CFS was going to have political advertising and there was a prohibition on political advertising on buses, was an unfair restriction on free expression that trans like was a government actor for the purposes of the charter, that the restriction that said no political advertising on buses was an illegal restriction. And this court went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. Very similar situation to the one that we're facing here in Vancouver with the Olympics. Here you have a quasi-public body whose board is appointed by government that is attempting to enforce a policy of no political or no political advertising, which they interpreted to include religious advertising that would have a political element, on what were otherwise pieces of public property, buses and the transit system, where certain kinds of other signs were already permitted. So you're already allowed to have a commercial sign on the side of a bus, but you weren't allowed to have a political sign on the side of a bus. And that was really important to the court in deciding that the limitations placed by TransLink on advertising were unconstitutional. So first of all, TransLink was found to be a government actor for the purposes of the charter, so we'll skip over that. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But in terms of the analysis, the court said some really interesting things about the application of free expression rights over bus property. So I'm just going to read a little bit to you from that. The proposed advertisements have expressive content that brings them within the prima facie protection of Section 2B, and the location of this expression, the sides of buses, does not remove that protection. Not only is there some history of use of this property as a space for public expression, but there is actual use, both of which indicate that the expressive activity in question neither impedes the primary function of the bus as a vehicle for public transportation, nor more importantly, undermines the values underlying freedom of expression. So here the court's saying, you're already using the buses for a certain type of public expression. There's a history of using buses for this type of public expression. Everyone's still going to be able to ride the bus, whether or not there are political advertisements on the bus. And so there's no compromise between allowing free expression and having a functioning transit system where everybody is welcome. The court goes on to say the space allows for expression by a broad range of speakers to a large public audience, and expression there could actually further the values underlying Section 2B. The side of a bus is therefore a location where expressive activity is protected by Section 2B of the Charter. Finally, the very purpose of the impugned policy is to restrict the content of expression in the advertising space on the sides of buses. The wording of Articles 2 and 7 clearly limits the content of advertisements. So when the court's looking at this, they're saying that the only purpose for the rules was to limit the kind of expression that you could have in this public area, which was the side of buses. And CFS was allowed to buy the advertising. They just were limited in what they could say within the advertised space. Theoretically, anybody could buy into an Olympic sponsorship and have their Olympic ads within the perimeters of the Olympic areas. But they can't actually do that because of the bylaw restrictions that say the signs must be celebratory. Okay? In addition, the idea that the court, I think, had so much difficulty with was that commercial advertising itself is not politically neutral. There's political values that are contained in the advertising that's put forward. And so you already have political ads of one type on the side of the bus, but you're not allowing political ads of another kind on the side of the bus. And so this case, we think, is you can extend it very easily to the Olympic scenario. Where you have public property traditionally used for public expression, there are a large number of streets involved. Venues like parks and libraries contained within the bylaws traditionally used for free and public expression. And the city is attempting to restrict not all advertising, this isn't a complete ban on every kind of message universally. They're trying to restrict the content of the messages that are distributed in these areas. And that's where I think they're going to fall apart on the TransLink issue. That's my second TransLink slide. This caused us to partner up with a couple folks who were interested in expressing themselves within these venues, around the outside of the Olympic venues, in the parks, in the streets of Vancouver, in filing a statement of claim against the city of Vancouver, arguing that the bylaws had as their express intent limiting free expression, that the bylaws were intended to restrict free expression in areas that were historically used and traditionally used for free expression. So from the pleadings themselves, I'll read some little segments from them. Schedule A, List 6, and you'll see that the language in the pleadings matches very closely to the TransLink case. We're not trying to make up new law here. We're trying to enforce what the Supreme Court of Canada has already said is the law around free expression. Schedule A lists 6 city sites. The historical and actual function of these sites include serving as sites for public assembly, political protest, and critical expression. Expressive activity is compatible with the historical and actual use of the sites. Section 104 lists venue corridors, pedestrian corridors, and Olympic lanes to include numerous arterial roads, including large sections of downtown, including Broadway, Burrard, Canby, Georgia, Dunsmuir, Hastings, Howe, Pender, Seymour, Beattie, Davie, Granville, Hamilton, and Robson Streets. The historical and current use of the corridors is compatible with expression. The purpose and effect of the restrictive expressions is to restrict the content of public expression and communication within and around large and central areas of Vancouver between January 1, 2010 and March 31, 2010. The restrictive provisions deny and are an infringement and an anticipatory infringement of the right to free expression as guaranteed by Section 2B of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and cannot be justified in a free and democratic society. So for those of you who have done your constitutional law, you're probably wondering about the Section 1 justification in the TransLink decision, because clearly there is a restriction on free expression, and most constitutional cases don't fall down on the restriction itself, but fall down on the justification later that the government's allowed to infringe your rights, but under the Oaks test, under the Section 1 test, they're permitted to infringe your rights because the court feels that there's a pressing and important objective that the government's trying to achieve with this restriction on rights that is more important than the restriction or proportionally appropriate to the restriction. For the TransLink decision, the court could not find that the limits on political content were rationally connected to the objective of providing a welcoming transit system, which is what the best the government could come up with in TransLink for why they were restricting free expression. The court said it's difficult to see how an advertisement on the side of a bus that constitutes political speech might create a safety risk or an unwelcoming environment for transit users. Moreover, the means chosen to implement the objective were neither reasonable nor proportionate to the interest in disseminating messages pursuant to their right under 2B of the Charter. So the court found that the policies were a blanket exclusion of very valued expression, that it wasn't a time, place, and manner restriction saying your sign could only be a certain size, or signs were only permitted during this time, or that you weren't allowed to use profanity. It was just a blanket expression on all kinds of political messages of every sort. And so the court said they couldn't figure out how the language itself would create a safety risk or an unwelcoming environment for transit users. And really, to prevent a 2B case from going ahead, you would have to really demonstrate when you're attempting to restrict free expression that there's some kind of safety risk prevented, some kind of safety risk created by the free expression itself. So that's why the hate speech provisions are upheld by the courts. The courts say, well, it's okay to restrict this kind of hate speech because it could cause people to react violently against vulnerable minorities. And so that limitation on free expression is protected. But here, where you have a political message, the court can't connect the safety risk to what's attempted to be done. And it would be very difficult, I think, for the city of Vancouver to make a financial argument in favor of restricting free expression, essentially arguing that the city, to put it in probably the most favorable terms, that the city's investment in the Olympics would potentially be lost or compromised, jeopardized, that the city would be in breach of a contract and potentially sued, because it shouldn't have signed the contract in the first place, because it didn't have the authority to sign the contract in the first place. So any potential loss was essentially created by the city. The city created an environment signing away the free expression rights, and they can't rely on that, what we believe is an illegal act, to defend its activities in restricting free expression. And we're going to see their statement of defense soon, but I'm just kind of speculating about the best possible arguments that they could bring forward, and it's difficult to know how they would rely on that. Agent provocateur. This is a shot from Montebello, which was a major protest related to trade issues. The two gentlemen who were on the ground were accused of being police officers. They were wearing balaclavas and carrying rocks. This photo shows that they were wearing the same boots as the arresting officers. So you see the boots of the arresting officers, and the boots of the people who were being arrested were the same boots. And then the Sûreté later admitted, the Sûreté de Quebec later admitted that they'd gone undercover in the protests around Montebello, and that actually these were officers of theirs who were carrying rocks and engaged in that kind of activity. I have some really fun footage of RCMP officers around Gustavson Lake discussing their smear and misinformation campaigns that they were engaged in around the protesters who were occupying land as part of an Aboriginal sovereignty claim, which I won't get into. But the activities of police in provoking violent reaction from security forces to give them an opportunity to arrest protesters has been an issue that's been raised for a while. But the police are limited in what they can do by the criminal code. Section 25.1 in the criminal code says it gives peace officers the ability to commit crimes in the following situations, in the course of an investigation of an offense, and if they're designated peace officers, and if they believe that the act itself is going to be less serious than the crime that they're investigating. But they're not allowed to engage in activities, they're even allowed to engage in activities that could result in loss of or serious damage to property, and directing people to engage in these kinds of activities, including their agents, as long as there's this proportionality analysis. The only limits on it are that and this is the provision that relates to a civilian who might engage in these kinds of activities at the direction of a police officer. They're also exempted from being convicted under the criminal code. But nothing in this section, the only limit is you can't intentionally or criminally negligently cause the death or bodily harm of another person, and you can't obstruct, pervert, or defeat the course of justice, and you can't sexually assault someone. So short of those, there is nothing that police officers are limited to in terms of the ability to break the law as agent provocateurs. Wrote a letter to CSIS and the ISU saying, hey, you guys, will you do us a favor and give us a couple guarantees? Will you guarantee that you won't cause bodily harm or death to any other person as a result of your undercover activities or encourage anyone to do that? Will you not infiltrate civil society groups and assume the leadership of those groups? Will you only infiltrate those groups that you believe are actually going to cause bodily harm to other people or serious property damage? Obviously, the response we got back, non-responsive from CSIS. Please be assured that CSIS works diligently to protect Canada's national security while respecting the rule of law, as well as the rights of citizens to lawful advocacy, protest, and dissent. The ISU responding, all intelligence activities of the ISU are, quote, conducted in conformity with Canadian law. In short, we're not going to give you any of those guarantees, which was very disappointing from our perspective that they wouldn't tell us, we won't assume the leadership of activist groups, we won't encourage people to engage in activity that could cause bodily harm or death. Instead, these sort of bald statements that they're going to follow the law. In terms of accountability, Vanock issued this community engagement considerations brochure to all the places along the torch route, all the municipalities. It set out activities of low concern and high concern. So low concern, welcome to our town, Olympic torch run. High concern, company name, share the flame, two-for-one Olympic torch relay special. Not okay. The concerning one to us was Vanock sending out this message that's saying, a commercial company distributing samples of their products to spectators, or an equivalent concern, a local politician distributing pamphlets along the route, would be of high concern. And up top under sampling, distribution of any propaganda or commercial products along the relay route is not permitted unless distributed by Vanock or OTR sponsors. So what is the accountability for Vanock? The women's ski jumper case addresses that issue squarely, finding that Vanock is actually bound by the charter. And there's a two-part test to finding that an agency is a government actor. The charter applies if the entity is controlled by government, but the charter also applies even if it's not controlled by government, if the entity is engaging in a traditionally governmental activity. So here the ski jumpers fell down on the first issue, which was that the court found that government did not control VanOck, despite the fact that government appoints the majority of the directors, funds at 50%, has a veto over the business plan and the schedule. Government apparently does not control VanOck. But where the ski jumpers succeeded was on government activity, saying that the staging of the games, it was awarded to a city, it wasn't awarded to a private entity. The hosting of the Olympics is a uniquely governmental activity. And so as a result, VanOck is bound by the charter. So theoretically, VanOck is subject to challenges for things like the Clean Venue Agreement, these are the ski jumpers, where it attempts to limit the ability of people to wear shirts, for example, that would say Free Tibet, in an organized fashion to get a message, a political message out under the Clean Venue Agreement, but also VanOck's ability to sign contracts that waive free expression rights, and VanOck's ability to ask the city of Vancouver for or demand bylaw concessions that address free expression rights. On the Legal Observer stuff, if you visit bccla.org, which is our website, there's a button on it about Legal Observers. It has all of the upcoming training dates if you want to be a Legal Observer. The Legal Observers are neutral third parties that observe protests and government security force interactions. We're looking for volunteers, particularly those that have some legal training, so that they can recognize potential rights violations and document them accurately. So thanks very much for having me.